This is the best of the Albert Mueller Program. We won't be taking your phone calls today, but stay tuned for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mueller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mueller Program. Just what is at stake in this big federal court case on same-sex marriage in California? Let me tell you, a whole lot more is at stake than marriage or same-sex marriage. What is increasingly clear is that what is at stake is whether secularism is the only acceptable public or legal posture to take in this country. Because the argument being made in that court is that there is no justifiable argument against gay marriage that isn't based in religion and thus an unconstitutional argument. Well, it's a fascinating argument. We'll be tracing it again today on the Albert Mueller Program. After all, there is far more here than meets the eye, and it has to do not only with California, not only with the issue of marriage or same-sex marriage, but with you and your ability to frame any argument in public about anything of importance to you. We'll be getting to that in just a moment. First, to review some issues in the news. This is Thursday, the 25th of February in the year 2010, and today is the day when President Obama has been scheduled to meet with legislative leaders in Congress, especially Republican leaders, in order to talk about a way forward on health care reform. Now, on Monday of this week, the president outlined his own health care proposal to try to get past what is being called the stalemate or impasse there in Washington. And let me tell you, as we're looking at this bill, it's becoming clear that there are a couple of things that should be of importance to every single American, and certainly those who care for the sanctity of human life, and that is that the Obama administration's bill is like the Senate bill on the question of abortion and not like the House bill. That's bad news. In the House of Representatives, the so-called Stupak Amendment is a stalwart, clear, and comprehensive assurance that no tax monies will go to underwrite abortion. In the Senate bill, there are loopholes and open doors that are simply unacceptable. There are a lot of other issues that I'm certain will be talked about in terms of the news media and public conversation about this health care debate and, of course, the health care proposal from the Obama administration. And it'll be interesting to see the fallout from the meeting today between the president and congressional leaders on the whole health care proposal. It'll be very interesting to see if what comes out of this is some kind of bipartisan agreement that can lead to legislation of unity, or whether there is a hardening of the sides and a polarization of the issues. We'll be watching that with you and ready to talk about it on the Albert Mueller Program. Meanwhile, there are other things to talk about as well. On this program, we've been tracing a development that is hidden to most Americans, but is of enormous consequence to almost every American. The American Psychiatric Association last week unveiled its much-awaited blueprint, that is, or draft, of what will become the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, 5th edition. That's DSM-5. Now, what we're really talking about here is the official manual of the psychiatric and psychological world. This manual describes what are recognized as legitimate psychological or psychiatric issues or diseases and what would be the appropriate treatment. So if you're in this, well, you get treatment and you're considered to be at least afflicted with some kind of illness or pathology. But if what you do is not in this, well, then it's outside of the tradition of the scope of psychiatry and psychology. Now, what's really interesting is that Sally Satel, writing for the Wall Street Journal, argues that this is a really bad revision, and for several reasons. For one thing, an enormous number of Americans who are not really afflicted by any psychological or psychiatric disease or illness would be defined as that. There's simply no question. She writes, the manual will not help. In fact, a number of changes diagnosed for DSM-5 are likely to inadvertently place large swaths of normal human variation under the umbrella of pathology. In other words, an enormous number of behaviors or issues that really should just be considered normal would be identified as pathology and thus needing treatment. Now, folks, that may seem like something of an academic or esoteric argument. You know, where does the water hit the wheel for the average American? Well, it hits the wheel in that you're going to have people who are not psychologically ill who may well be designated as being psychologically ill or in need of psychiatric treatment, and that's not good news. More, Sally Satel writes, the upshot is that with some important exceptions, Drug treatment is often guided more by symptoms by diagnosis. She goes on to say that the DSM is relied on too much. There's simply no substitute for observing the patient, listening to his story, and fine-tuning his treatment. Psychological and pharmacological is needed. Therefore, the previous edition, the DSM-3, the writers knew this well. They cautioned against manual users taking too literally the sharp boundaries between disorders and between disorder and mental health. Quote, this version is only one still frame in the ongoing process of attempting to better understand mental disorders. She writes, 30 years later, despite undeniable progress in brain science, we're saying much the same thing, which is back off. And, of course, from the Christian worldview perspective, there's a lot of really important stuff at stake here. Because an awful lot of what we would consider to be matters of the Christian's spiritual health or unhealth are here just dealt with as matters of psychiatric or psychological interest. What we have is a therapeutic society becoming more and more bent on therapy. When what a lot of people need when it comes to their psychological syndrome or illness or disease or whatever they want to call it is not therapy but just some common sense, maybe even the ability to talk a bit. But for all human beings, what we know as Christians is that therapy won't save. Only the gospel saves. And the real problem in this is that people are going to try to find salvation in some kind of treatment or therapy when it will not be found. There's another fascinating book out. It's entitled Voodoo Histories, The Role of Conspiracy Theory in Shaping Modern Histories by David Aronovich. And it's one of those books that catches my attention right away because it scratches an itch. And the itch is this. Why are so many Americans prone to believe in conspiracy theories? And he writes, well, it turns out part of human nature. It turns out that it appears that humans are sometimes more drawn to intricate and unlikely arguments than they are to simple and obvious arguments. Not like that. I think from a Christian perspective, there's something that is very, very interesting there. Why is it that human beings are often drawn to complicated and unlikely explanations when the obvious is right there before them? I think it has to do with what Paul writes about in Romans chapter 1, where he says that sinners suppress the truth and unrighteousness. And if you're going to suppress the truth and unrighteousness, well, in a sophisticated age, you have to do it in a sophisticated way. If you're going to suppress the truth and unrighteousness, you're going to have to come up with some kind of syndrome, some kind of conspiracy theory, some kind of grand universal theory of everything in order to explain that we are not the problem. Now, let's face it, conspiracy theories are interesting. And, of course, as we look at so many of the most important historical events of recent years and of ancient history, many of them are particularly interesting because there are big questions about who were the actors involved and why exactly was this done? Why did this happen? But it isn't healthy for people to try to live in a world of conspiracy theories. You know, sometimes the simple and obvious explanation is indeed the truth, the simple and obvious explanation. There's another report out. The Los Angeles Times had this. It caught my attention. It's talking about something I hadn't heard about before, but once you hear it, you're going to nod your head because you're going to recognize it. It is a new syndrome. It's entitled Teenage Night Owl Syndrome. And it turns out that teenagers, of course, adolescents, are going to sleep later and needing even more sleep than many of their school schedules and other schedules allow. Now it turns out, Thomas Ma, writing for the Los Angeles Times, it turns out that one of the reasons this may be so is that teenagers are deprived of light in the morning, therefore their body clock never gets set. If they get up and it's dark, and they go out and it's dark, and they go into the school, and the school is itself not well lit, their body clocks are saying it's still night, it's delaying their ability to respond to the morning. I don't know if this is truth or not, but I'll tell you, it is an undeniable fact that teenagers tend to stay up late and seem to want to sleep late. Mariana Figuero, a sleep researcher at the Lighting Research Center, says these morning light-deprived teenagers are going to bed later, getting less sleep, and possibly underperforming on standardized tests. We are starting to call this teenage night owl syndrome. So what is the answer? Well, at least part of the answer here, according to this article, is getting better lighting in schools, better lighting that mimics sunlight so that their body clocks are reset. You know, something tells me that human nature is really at work here. The reality is that we have become more and more a 24/7 society in which more and more the interesting stuff takes place at night. we're able to create all of these electronic cocoons around ourselves so that it really doesn't matter whether it's day or night. And life is becoming more like the operation of a hospital 24/7, 7 days a week. You know, when teenagers used to get up and go out and bale hay in the morning, they got plenty of sun. But quite frankly, that was true not only for teenagers, but for the rest of us. Maybe this is a reminder that we weren't meant to live in caves, as this report says, and we certainly weren't meant to live in the dark. You know, from a Christian perspective, in a whole lot of ways, that makes a whole lot of sense. Back to talk about why the federal case over same-sex marriage isn't a trial that's just about marriage. It's about secularism, and that means it's about you. We'll be right back with the Albert Mueller Program.
This is the best of the Albert Mueller Program.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. You know, one of the big questions that the gay rights movement has really had to struggle with in recent years is when to go to the courts. And when you, for instance, look at the issue of abortion, you realize you go back to the 1973 decision in Roe v. Wade. Those who were pushing for a woman's right to have an abortion knew that they weren't going to get it through the state legislatures, that they were never going to get a uniform abortion rights law across America. So they understood the way to get what they wanted was to go to the courts. And they did so at the time for their argument that was just right. It was a 5-4 decision in 1973 in the decision Roe v. Wade. And they had that timed just right. And I think horribly, tragically so. And we're still bearing the aftermath of Roe v. Wade. The most horrible aspect of that aftermath is over 50 million aborted babies. But the other side of that is that the Supreme Court also found itself in a very difficult position. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in the last several months, has made a very interesting argument when she says it would have been better for the High Court in 1973 to have ruled narrowly in that case and to have allowed the society to catch up a bit before ordering the legalization of all abortions. Now, if you're from a pro-choice or pro-abortion perspective, that becomes an interesting argument. But it ought to tell us something. It tells us that there you have a liberal justice who's admitting that the court was way out ahead of the American people. Now, what's interesting on the same-sex marriage question is this. The gay rights movement, the powers that be, have had the strategy of trying to hold back from going to the federal courts because they have felt that the U.S. Supreme Court right now, with a conservative majority, would not be likely to argue or to find that the U.S. Constitution includes a right of same-sex marriage. And so they have decided to hold back from going to the federal courts. But outside of their control, a federal court case came. And it came because of plaintiffs in California. In the aftermath of California voters adopting Proposition 8, the constitutional amendment that stipulated that marriage is a heterosexual union, these plaintiffs got two of the most high-powered attorneys in America to go into the federal court there in California to make the argument that, indeed, Proposition 8 is unconstitutional. Now, the gay rights movement, in terms of its senior leadership, was very alarmed by this and felt that the timing was bad, and there's still that argument going on in that community. But nonetheless, the case is going forward. And the attorneys put together to push for same-sex marriage are David Boies and Ted Olson. And that's what's really interesting. If you recall those names, you'll remember that they were the opposing attorneys in the 2000 case Bush v. Gore, where David Boies represented Al Gore and Ted Olson, who had been or would be Solicitor General of the United States, was representing George W. Bush. And so you had a titanic fight. They went to the Supreme Court, but now they're on the same side. And by the way, one of the things we'll have to look at some point is the argument Ted Olson is trying to present. Newsweek magazine cover story a couple weeks back, what he calls the conservative case for gay marriage. We're going to leave that for a moment, and let's just get to what they actually said in court, because both sides have now rested. The case is before U.S. District Judge Von Walker. He'll be making his decision, and there'll be final arguments. All that will be coming down in upcoming weeks. It's expected probably about March or April that decision be handed down. But let me tell you what Boies and Olson did when they got into court. They didn't argue that the people of California had no right to vote on this. They argued that the entire effort and that those who voted against gay marriage, that they were driven by a sense of moral opposition to homosexuality. And indeed, using the word moral opprobrium. And that word comes from the 2003 U.S. Supreme Court case, Lawrence v. Texas, in which the majority opinion, in that case was another very close case, but that majority opinion was written by Anthony Kennedy. Justice Kennedy said that mere moral opprobrium or moral opposition or a moral outrage is no sufficient ground for discrimination. And so that's exactly what Olson and Boies decided to argue in court. They went into that California federal courtroom and argued that the voters of California were driven by moral opposition to homosexuality. And they argued that that was essentially Christian opposition. In other words, the vote was to be cast out as unconstitutional, they argued, because Christians in California voted their conscience on homosexuality rather than merely on the question of marriage. Now, just think about that for a moment. I hope you're listening. We could have chosen other things to talk about today, but I think this one is simply too important. I don't think I could have gone into the weekend with a clear conscience without having brought this to your attention today. Michael Lindenberger, reporter with Time Magazine, has done an outstanding job of dealing with this issue and following this case, wrote in an article published at Time this morning that the case has finally put the issue of same-sex marriage before the federal courts, setting the stage for a landmark decision either way the judge rules and however the case is finally decided upon appeals. He says, quote, both sides see it as a crucial test of whether society can insist that heterosexual unions are worthy of the full sanction of the law in a way that other unions are not. He also says this. He says, quote, for decades, governments at every level have created one set of rules for heterosexuals in America and another set for its gays and lesbians, end quote. Now, that's only partly true. He says there are two sets of rules, one for heterosexuals and the other for homosexuals. That's close, but it's not right. It is true that governments have established one set of rules for married heterosexual couples and another set of rules for everyone else. So in other words, it's not just gays and lesbians that do not have these rights. Anyone who's not in a married heterosexual union does not have these rights. But now you have Boies and Olson making a further argument, and this is where it gets really interesting. Let me just read to you what Lindenberger says. This is important. For his part, Boies told Time that the trial has shown that legal discrimination against gays, in particular rules banning their marriage, starts with simple prejudice in the form of religion-inspired views about the morality of homosexuality itself. Listen carefully here, folks. He writes, quote, this is David Boies. The Southern Baptist Convention describes homosexuality as an abomination, Boies told Time, as he prepared for what would be 3 days of sometimes blistering cross-examinations as the trial wound down. He said, quote, the Catholic Church calls homosexual activity gravely immoral. Who is kidding whom? These are sincerely held beliefs to which they are certainly entitled, but no one ought to kid themselves that what is behind efforts to ban gay marriage is anything other than a majority imposing its beliefs on other people, end quote. Now, let me just put this bluntly. If David Boies' argument here pertains, then you and I are just out of the discussion. Because we are believers in the gospel of Christ, and we have certain convictions. And because we have those convictions, David Boies says, we're not to be allowed. Now, Michael Lindenberger called me, asked me to respond to that, and I did. And this is from his article in Time magazine. The Reverend Albert Mohler, a leading figure in the fight against gay marriage, says that in light of Lawrence, he understands Boies' line of attack. But he told Time that marriage is different. It is the central institution of human society. The problem with that argument, that is, I'm speaking here, Boies' argument, is that the current case has to do with marriage, not merely with the right to engage in certain sexual acts. There's more than ample ground to argue that the sustenance of marriage is necessary for the flourishing of human culture. Thus, anything that damages marriage or subverts its place in society is harmful in its effects. In other words, I'm making the argument that there are many reasons why Christians may be opposed to same-sex marriage. And the main reason Christians are opposed to same-sex marriage is not opposition to homosexuality, but rather support for marriage as an institution. If the argument being made in this federal court holds, it will effectively establish secularism as the only acceptable worldview to have anything to do with public policy. I'd love to hear what you think about this. Give me a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Coast to coast with listeners around the world, you're listening to the Albert Mohler Program.
This is the best of the Albert Mueller program. We won't be taking your phone calls today, but stay tuned for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mueller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. The issue of marriage and the challenge of same-sex marriage, that's a big enough issue to have our concern. But the argument put forth in the trial going on in the federal court in California right now is bigger than that. It is far bigger than that. And I want to tell you why. It is because the argument put forth by those who are defending same-sex marriage and opposing Proposition 8, that is David Boies and Ted Olson, is that the voters of California acted unconstitutionally because they believe that homosexuality is a sin, and thus they opposed same-sex marriage on that ground. And I've had people write me, even in the course of the day today, and say, where's this coming from? Well, I wrote about it in the article I published this morning, and it comes down to this. For the last, say, 50 or 60 years, in American universities and law schools, you've had the argument put forth that a liberal society must exclude religious doctrines. And this is not just the separation of church and state. That's a long American argument. This has to do with the fact that in the making of public policy, these, and they are on the liberal side, secularists have argued that you have to exclude religious arguments from the debate, especially where it comes to limiting human behavior. Any law that would limit a human behavior, any law that would say you can't do that, they say has to be justified on entirely secular grounds. Now, Robert Audi, who teaches at the University of Nebraska, has taken that argument to its conclusion in probably the most influential form. He argues that any proposal to limit a human behavior, regardless of what it is, it could be to say that you can't murder, or it could be to say you can't jaywalk, okay? Any law that would limit human behavior has to be justified on these two grounds. Number one, he says, on its secular form or its secular reason or argumentation, rationale, and secondly, on its secular motivation. So secular rationale is first. That means you have to make the argument based upon purely secular terms. You can't say that it's wrong to murder someone because God says thou shalt not murder. Instead, you have to say you can't murder someone because, try to make that argument an entirely secular way and you'll see the problem. And nonetheless, that's the way they're trying to argue it. You can't say it's morally wrong to commit adultery. All you can say is that there's some secular purpose that is accomplished by the law in criminalizing adultery. You could come up with all kinds of examples. But then they take the argument a step further, that is, Boies and Olson in the California courtroom, and Robert Audi in his academic argument. Audi says, in order to make that kind of proposal to limit any human behavior, you also have to be driven, now get this, by a secular motivation. Now, that's what's really interesting. I wonder if this federal court judge is going to try to do a psychoanalysis on the voters of California. How do you know someone's motivation? How well do you even know your own motivation? Now, let me just make a statement here, and I want you to test this. Just think about this. When you go into a voting booth to vote for candidate A or candidate B for president of the United States, your worldview matters. It matters intensely. You may go into that court, that voting booth, having a pattern of liking one candidate and disliking the other. You may like the way the one looks. You may like the voice of one more than another. You may like the partisan identification of one candidate more than the other. You may have certain issues that are to you non-negotiable. You may like the fact that this one's a better speaker, but that one once served as governor. You may like the fact that this one is pro-life, and you may like the fact that the other one over here has a particular law related to, you name it, that you like. But when you actually vote, how well do you know your heart to know what percentage was driven by factor A, what percentage was driven by factor B, what percentage was driven by factor C? My guess is you could not psychoanalyze yourself. And here's a basic insight of the Christian worldview. We all have a worldview. We are all driven by deeply held convictions, and we do not know ourselves well enough to know how those convictions even affect us. We may know, for instance, you say, well, I'd never vote for a pro-choice candidate. Well, now you know. But on the other hand, if you're choosing between two, say, pro-life candidates, why do you vote for one rather than the other? You don't know. Folks, if this argument pertains, then if Olson and Boies have their way, then the only way you can enter into a debate is if you're secular. Now, just think about what that means. That means the vast majority of Americans can't have a say. These two attorneys are literally arguing that the people of California have no right to decide what marriage is. Folks, this case is huge. I guarantee you it's going to be appealed all the way to the Supreme Court, whichever way it goes, because both sides understand how huge it is. But this case goes far beyond marriage, because if the logic of attorneys David Boies and Theodore Olson pertains in this case and is affirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court, then not only are all efforts to regulate marriage just gone, but the reality is, on any great moral issue, people who are identified and self-consciously Christian are going to be excluded from the conversation. That ought to tell you something. The phone number is 877-893-8255. We'll be right back with calls.
This is the best of the Albert Mueller Program.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. We're going to go right to calls. Let's go to Bruce calling from Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Bruce.
Yeah, Dr. Mueller, my wife represented the Christian Coalition in a TV debate with the head of the Gay and Lesbian Alliance in Alabama on traditional and gay marriage. He tried to define the issue as a civil right. She seized the issue on secular grounds and said it was really an issue of redefining marriage. And on that basis, she wiped him out. And Christians need to learn to seize the issue, to define it correctly, and not let the gay and lesbian movement define it for what it is not, a civil right.
Hey, Bruce, I appreciate your call, and that's a very good example of how to make an argument in the public square, and a very legitimate argument. I really appreciate you sharing that about the debate. You know, in the article that I published today on this very issue, I make the same argument. I make it the way I routinely have to deal with people in the press about it, and that's this. The issue is marriage and society's right to establish and privilege marriage as one thing and not another thing, with the particular motivation of society explicitly being for the sustenance of marriage as the place for the greatest flourishing of children, the raising of children. That has been the historic argument for privileging marriage. It's in the law. It's in British common law or English common law. It's in continental European law. It's even, and this is what's really important here, it's even in law where there is no Christian influence, for instance, or no theistic influence. And, you know, one of the things that you have to take into consideration, you know, I wish I'd had a chance to debate David Boies on this. And since he came at me, citing me in this in his argument, I would love to have been able to have an opportunity to respond to him. I would have said this: look, how do you explain how Confucian cultures in the East establish heterosexual marriage and reject homosexual marriage? You can't say it's because of biblical opposition. You can't say it's because of Christian opposition. You can't say it's because of Judeo-Christian opposition. You can't even say it's because of theistic opposition to homosexuality. That's not there. But every single society throughout human history has found its way to privileging heterosexual marriage as marriage for the flourishing of human society in general, and especially the flourishing of children in particular. Bruce, here's what's different about what's going on here. The argument being made in the California case is not just about the secular rationale. That's where your wife did such a good job in answering the advocates of same-sex marriage. They are arguing beyond secular rationale to secular motivation. And that's what's so dangerous, because they're saying if you're a Christian, then your argument has to be driven by Christianity, even if it's not an explicitly Christian argument. Even if you shift it from, say, gay rights to redefining marriage, their new argument is if you are motivated by being a Christian and making that argument, then it's illegitimate. And, of course, that's mind reading. And yet it's the very case they've made in this California courtroom. They really didn't make any other case. They're resting their entire argument on the judge in that California courtroom, U.S. District Court Judge Vaughn Walker, saying, okay, I'm going to mind read the California public. And since the majority of them are Christians and they presumably would hold to a Christian opposition to homosexuality, that must be what motivates them. Therefore, it's unconstitutional. That's why this is so dangerous. Thanks for your call, Bruce. Let's go to Rochester, New Hampshire. David's listening on the World Wide Web. Go ahead, David.
Hi, Dr. Mueller. Thank you for taking my call. It seems to me that if they succeed in disallowing a Christian basis or a moral point of view that's at all Christian in nature, as a, then isn't that leading towards establishing secular humanism as a national religion?
Yes.
A long ways down the road, but isn't that...
Absolutely.
Legally?
No, David, you are absolutely right, and that's exactly why I felt we just had to talk about this today. You could call it secular humanism, you could call it secularism, but the net result is the same. That is exactly what we're talking about. The article I published this morning, I said this, that to some degree, what we have here is a logic that says the establishment of secularism is the only acceptable faith in postmodern America. Only by denying any religious faith could a citizen prove his or her secular motivation. In other words, if being a Christian, if identifying as a Christian is enough for a judge to say, well, then that's what motivates you to do X or Y, then he's mind reading. And if thus Christians are excluded, then David, you're exactly right. Then the majority of American citizens are going to be excluded from the public conversation about public policy. And I just think most Christians think, okay, there's a case going on in California, a federal court case, and it's a big case on same-sex marriage, and it could go one way or the other. We'll just see. I'm trying to set off an alarm about far deeper and more important issues even than marriage and same-sex marriage. And that has to do with whether or not Christians are even able to participate in arguments in the public square. Because if this logic holds, David, you're exactly right. We have here an establishment of secularism or of humanism as the national faith, more or less, because you can only enter into debate if you're adequately secular. And you know, that's the amazing thing. Folks, in large sectors of America, it's already that way. I think David made the point we're already way down the road. Let me tell you, just to try to get a job in a lot of circles, if you're well-known and open and professing as a Christian believer. Now, thankfully, there is good legal reason to believe that you can't get away with that discrimination. But just in terms of the way people hire, I mean, especially in elite academia, especially in a lot of the culture-making enterprises, it's explicitly secular. It's openly hostile to those who would come with an explicit, open, professed Christian faith. Well, now you have this kind of hostility taking the form of an argument put forth in the U.S. federal court district. And that district court judge, Vaughn Walker, there in that case, being heard in California, is going to make a decision that will be appealed whatever his decision, whichever way he goes, the losing side will appeal first to the 9th U.S. District Court of Appeals in San Francisco, and then ultimately to the U.S. Supreme Court. There are those who believe that this case could be before the U.S. Supreme Court as early as spring of the year 2011. There are others who believe that it could come even sooner than that, if indeed an appellate court decides to just kick it upstairs, it could be even late this spring that the case could come before the Supreme Court. Now, again, that leads to political questions about which side's likely to win. That leads back to the political strategy of the gay rights movement and trying to figure out if this is the right time or not. Those are significant questions, but I think far more significant is the question of whether or not the argument put forth in that courtroom holds. Because if it does, the vast majority of Americans are being told, you can't speak on any matter like this where it relates to public policy if you're a Christian. We'll be right back.
This is the best of the Albert Mueller Program.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. I hope you see in a whole new way why this case is really important. And even as we're talking now in February, the year 2010, and that decision is not handed down yet. We're expecting it sometime in the spring. And we know that that case is on appeal, going to go all the way, not only to the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco, but almost surely to the United States Supreme Court. I hope we see that much more is at stake than mere marriage. And that's not to say that marriage isn't enough to put this on the front burner of every single American, because especially those of us who know that marriage was given to us by God as a gift that is essential for human society, we understand that the penalty of tampering with marriage is going to be the weakening of all social bonds, the undermining and subversion of society writ large, and eventually a great deal of incalculable human misery and a lack of human flourishing that's going to follow by disregarding God's plan. But it's not just about marriage. It's not just about same-sex marriage. It's really about this argument that the plaintiffs are making in the case when they're trying to press the point that it's all about the absolute necessity of making absolutely secular arguments motivated by absolutely secular motivations, or you're unconstitutional, out of bounds, uncool, and out of here. And that means that the vast majority of Americans will be disenfranchised. You know, there's something else going on here. There is, of course, a very organized and persistent hostility to Christianity. That comes out, well, frankly, it comes out of the pores of the arguments that are being made by those who are the plaintiffs in this case. They're making the case that there's an odious, lamentable, phobic reaction against homosexuality on the part of Americans that is deeply rooted in Christianity. But there's not only this kind of organized opposition, there's also this creeping secularization that comes in and seems to make sense to an awful lot of people who otherwise should know better. When you say to someone who walks on the street, you say to someone in the classroom or on the campus or at the workplace, you know, I really think that one's religious perspectives should have absolutely nothing to do with debates over public policy and law and all the rest. There's a sense in which an awful lot of Americans think they ought to just nod their heads in absolute and total agreement. And here's the problem. As a human being, you can't separate your motivations, your convictions, your worldview, your passions, your intuitions, and your emotions from the totality of who you are. There is no way, as a believer in the gospel of Jesus Christ, you can separate your belief about life and death and meaning and institutions and marriage and everything in between, even love itself, without reference to Christianity. And we need to admit that right up front. But the same is true for the secularist. The secularist also cannot separate all those different intuitions and emotions and beliefs and decisions and perceptions from his or her own secularism. And that should mean it's all equal, all of it equally valid. We make the best argument we can make, and eventually the American people are going to have to decide this issue. We'll be tracing it for you. Thanks for listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.